with others. I studied mathematics also with a graduate student who became professor of mathematics at CIT.
Who was that?
Morgan Ward, Professor Morgan Ward. He was an algebraist. We got along well. We got well acquainted as one could get, I think, with Harry Bateman, mainly with his wife. But he was always thinking about mathematics. We went to see them once at their home in La Cañada, and Mrs. Bateman called to Harry, and he came out, and he shook hands with me and shook hands with my wife and then shook hands with Mrs. Bateman. Still thinking about some differential equation that he was working on.
That reminds me, I digression, but it reminds me of a story about Hermann Schlesinger that I heard a couple of years ago at an ACS meeting, where he used to be in the habit of taking his kids out for a walk, and he'd bring along a couple of issues of Jacks and get lost thinking about chemistry. And one day he came back from the walk, and his wife said, "Where are the kids?"
Yes.
He left them in the park.
Yes. Tell a story about that fellow at MIT who invented the word, the governor, you know, what is that expression? A mathematician. Controlling, the science of controlling things.
Oh, cybernetics.
Cybernetics,
is that
yes.
Wiener?
Wiener. That they moved, and he couldn't remember his new house. So he stopped a little kid on the street and said, "Do you know where Professor Wiener lives?" And he said, "Yes, in that house, Papa."
Well, sometimes I think I'm disorganized. It hasn't gotten to that. Yeah. Well, it's from what you've been telling me is very interesting, because it sounds as though you had a lot of contact with the mathematicians at Caltech. That you were obviously very comfortable with the sorts of things that they were doing that you were doing. Who were the people you would talk chemistry with all the time? Was it Dickinson mainly, or were there fellow students in addition to Paul Emmett, who you lived with for a year at least?
The other graduate students, well, Oliver Wolf, he's just died a month or two ago. His secretary, his wife was secretary to Dr. Noyce later, after he retired in Washington and they came back to Pasadena, or rather after he was posted to CIT by the Weather Bureau for a good number of years. And she became my secretary, Oliver Wolf, Mrs. Wolf, B. Wolf. We saw a lot of the Wolfs. And in later years, too, in Washington, D.C., of them and Paul Emmett and his wife. Tolman was 20 years older, can that be right, than I. G.N. Lewis was 25 years older, I think. Roscoe was 10 years older, approximately. Chemistry at CIT was mainly physical chemistry. Howard Lucas was there doing good work. He didn't have a PhD. A.A. Noyce didn't think much of him, but here he became a member of the National Academy of Sciences and had outstanding students who wrote a very good textbook. So Noyes asked me in 1930, about 32 or 3 perhaps, if I would be willing to be professor of organic chemistry and to build up organic chemistry. Well, that shows he didn't know much about organic chemistry. I just rejected that idea. But that was because I was making contributions to the understanding of organic chemistry without knowing the art at all, the practical side.
Well, it's an interesting reflection of Noyes' attitudes, I think. Speaking of art, that was another thing I wanted to ask you about. I was intrigued in reading some of the papers you wrote about the early days of X-ray crystallography, that Burdick had constructed the first 2 X-ray spectrometers in the U.S. after coming back from the Brax laboratory.
Yes.
And this was something that must really have been a craft that you...
Yes, and Noyes was responsible. Burdick was working for his PhD in Germany when Noyes wrote to him. He got his PhD, I think, then, this was during the war, in Switzerland. And Noyes wrote to him and told him he should go to London, to Bragg, or to Leeds, I think, and learn X-ray spectrometry, X-ray diffractometry. So he did, and he and a man named Owen, E.A. Owen, published a paper on the structure of silicon carbide, carborundum. This was work done in England. Then he came to MIT and built an X-ray, well, that's in that report, built an X-ray spectrometer. And then Noyes got him to come to Pasadena, and he built another one. And there were parts of it around when I was a graduate student, although we no longer used that spectrometric technique.
Well, when you came down to Pasadena, I mean, how could you just talk a little bit about learning that the craft? I mean, did Dickinson put somebody in charge of teaching you the technique, or
No, he did it. He was a National Research Council fellow. Mm-hmm. He had got his PhD 2 years before. And perhaps he had this National Research Council fellowship for 3 years, I'm not sure. Or at any rate, I was his only graduate student. He told me how to set up a crystal in front of the X-ray beam, and then and how to develop the plate and the Lau photograph and make the rotation photograph, spectral photograph, measure them up, and then how to plot, make a mnemonic projection of the Lau photograph, just step by step, and taught me one after another the basic principles of space group theory and of crystallography. The zones, planes and zones, the laws by means of which you can find what plane lies in 2 zones. And I have a feeling that I was a good graduate student in that he probably never had to tell me anything twice.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were certainly very productive in those early years. Published a whole series of papers, first with him and then by yourself on structures.
And I read the literature and I studied in my courses, which were mainly physics courses, except for these courses that Tolman gave that I've mentioned in chemistry, which was sort of mainly quantum chemistry, quantum physics. There's no doubt, I'm sure, that the statement I made that there's no place in the world where I could have gone at that time to get a better education than I got there.
No, it was quite a remarkable group of people who Noyes had brought together.
Yes, Tolman probably deserves most of the credit for the Noyes determined the nature of the Institute. Milliken was the sort of front man. Noyes determined academic policy. No women admitted. That was a waste of time, in his opinion, a waste of effort. And he set up the junior travel prize so that the best junior student was sent for 6 months to Europe, given money, and got academic credit for it. That he lost one term, but and plus the summer. But he got credit for the term. So 1 year, then, 1924, there were two that they had trouble deciding between. So they gave the junior travel prize to both of them. We met them in Rome, my wife and I. Let's see, I'm going to a later time now. I think it was 1925 that there were two of them, not 1920, or 1926 perhaps. Yes, it was 1926. Then the next, then they were Carl Anderson and Fred Ewing. Fred Ewing didn't have much of a career. He developed Huntington's disease in middle life. And Carl Anderson, of course, discovered the positron. The next year, there was a class that I had taught as freshman where one of them got published his first paper with me for research done as a freshman student in the following summer. Edwin McMillan.
Yeah, he's promising, I guess.
There were eight out of the dozen members of Section A, the honor section, when eight juniors who were selected for the Junior Travel Prize, and Dr. Noyes probably put up the money for it. So the eight of them showed up in Europe. So we saw Carl Anderson and Fred Ewing in Rome on Easter Day, 1926, and we saw the eight a year later when they came to Munich.
Well, I guess by having such a small student body, Caltech could afford to really invest that kind of time and resources in it.
For example, Ken Pitzer published a couple of papers with A.A. Noyes when he was a junior. And he published a paper for work done under my direction, but by himself, a crystal structure job, when he was a senior. And then went to Berkeley and got his Ph.D. in 2 years and was made assistant professor. It's an excellent, or it was an excellent place. It's got pretty big now. They still have 760 undergraduates, but they have, I think, 760 graduate students now.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, a big difference. Yeah, well, let's see. We're up to about 1925, I guess, when you were just before, or a year before, you went over to Europe as a Guggenheim Fellow. One question maybe we come back to that in a little while, but I, in addition to the crystal structure studies that you were doing, I read a couple of the early papers you published on chemical structure and bonding while you were still at Caltech.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the first was still using the Bohr theory.
Yes.
And when were you beginning to become familiar with the new quantum mechanics before you went over to Europe?
Well, the new quantum chemistry didn't exist yet. But before I went to Europe in March I guess, March of, we left in March. I had heard lectures by Born on the old quantum theory, I think still in 1925. So Heisenberg in 1925 discovered quantum mechanics, published his first paper. Born and Jordan noticed that what he used was matrix mechanics, which was a well-developed field of mathematics that Heisenberg didn't know about. And they published papers on matrix mechanics. And here Born the same year, or December of 25, or perhaps January, I think it was December of 1925, gave some lectures on matrix mechanics in Pasadena, which I attended and took notes on, and tried to use, but I gave up. It was just too difficult. It was very hard to apply it to the hydrogen atom. Pauli succeeded in treating the hydrogen atom with matrix mechanics. So it was with the old quantum theory still that I was trying to understand chemistry, and not very successfully. And other people were trying to develop a theory of the hydrogen molecule, or the hydrogen molecule ion even. Pauli didn't succeed, or Heisenberg, when they tried to treat that problem. It took the Schrödinger wave equation to permit chemical quantum chemistry to be born. My early effort, where I assigned structures to benzene and naphthalene with Bohr orbits, sort of, was rather amateurish, I would say. It showed some imagination, perhaps. There were other ideas that people were putting forth about structure, and this idea, I think, wasn't any worse than some of the others.
I was just interested that it showed you had continued to think about those questions that you, well, you mentioned earlier today that you had interested you when you first came across Lewis and Langer's work in the journals. And your European, first European sojourn from 1926 to 27, I know you discussed at some length in the Archive for History of Quantum Physics and other interviews, but it, you mentioned a little while ago that Caltech was a very stimulating environment when you got there. How did you find things when you got to Europe?
Well, I provided my own stimulus pretty much. Sommerfeld suggested a problem to me when I arrived, that I work on the anomalous g-factor of the electron. Check up on what Max Abraham had written around 1900, which I did, but it didn't really interest me. It never came to anything. I didn't manage to develop anything. I had applied the old quantum theory to the problem of the dielectric constant of a dipole gas in a magnetic field, and made some predictions which were checked by experiment and found to be wrong about the time that I went to Europe. A man in the physics department carried out the experiment. So I attacked the problem as soon as Schrödinger published his papers. I attacked the problem of the dielectric constant, the motion of a dipole molecule in crossed electrostatic and magnetic fields, and solved it. And I was trying to develop the quantum theory of electric and magnetic susceptibilities at the same time Van Vleck was. And I had some results, but Van Vleck made a very thorough study of those problems. So I attacked problems that Sommerfeld didn't know about or wasn't interested in, essentially chemical problems. The first one, I found a paper by Gregor Wenzel just published in Zeitschrift für Physik. He was Privatdozent to Sommerfeld. And the paper was on the theoretical calculation of the screening constants, X-ray doublet screening constants by quantum mechanics for atoms with many electrons. And he had used an idea of Schrödinger's of idealizing inner shells as spherical, just inner electrons by spherical shell of negative electric charge with orbits penetrating. Schrödinger had published this about 1920. And he had put in quantum corrections, changed the equations of classical quantum, old quantum theory, to the corresponding equations in quantum mechanics, and published the results, which were that the experimental values, the observed values, didn't agree with the theory. Well, this was just what I was hoping to get involved in. He treated atoms with as many electrons as you wanted, you know, many electron atoms. And even though his theory didn't agree with experiment, I thought maybe I could use it with my interest in atoms that have many electrons and in molecules. So I read the paper. Instead of just reading the paper, I went from one equation to the next equation. Pretty soon I derived the equations, and pretty soon I found that my equations were not the same as his equations. Uh-huh. He had just, in fact, made a mistake. So I took this to Sommerfeld, who showed it to Wenzel. My screening constants for these relativistic or magnetic X-ray doublets agreed with the experiment. So there wasn't any. So I wrote a paper, Eine Bemerkung über die Abschirmungskonstanten der magnetischen und relativistischen Röntgendoblätten, and published it in Zeitschrift für Physik. And then I went ahead to use the same method, an expansion on what Wenzel, a correction of what Wenzel had done, and an expansion to calculate many properties of atoms and ions. And so I published several papers on that basis. Well, you see, I had plenty of problems, things that I was interested in. One of them was sizes of ions, and these screening constants permitted me to derive my ionic radii. And that led to principles determining the structure of complex ionic compounds, the silicates and many other. In general, practically all oxygen compounds are compounds of the halogens. I have mentioned that when I went to Zurich, and my wife and I, after being for a month in Copenhagen, I was supposed to be working with Schrödinger, but I didn't bother him with my presence. I just worked on my own problem of the interaction of two helium atoms. A little later, I published a paper on He2 plus, the three-electron bond, and later developed the theory of the three-electron bond, as well as the one-electron bond. There were all sorts of problems in chemistry that could be attacked once the Schrödinger wave equation was formulated, and the general principles about perturbation theory, especially, had been discovered.
Was there when you learned X-ray techniques from Dickinson, that was, you know, working directly with him, and he'd sort of show you the technique step by step. Was there a similar kind of interaction with when you were over in Europe and working on quantum mechanics, or was that pretty much a question of working through the material yourself?
I was fortunate. During the year that I was there, Sommerfeld gave lectures on wave mechanics. Schrödinger's papers were just coming out. And so Sommerfeld gave a course on wave mechanics while the papers were still being published. And I think later another course. I attended these lectures and read the papers. And Sommerfeld had a seminar, too. I probably reported on something in the seminar, although I don't remember doing so. I remember a seminar at which another American was supposed to present Sommerfeld's paper on the second or on the Stark effect of the hydrogen atom. And he started out trying to talk in German, but he got mixed up and couldn't remember the German words, so Sommerfeld said he should present it in English. Unfortunately, he didn't know the material well enough, didn't understand it well enough to present it in English.
Brilliant.
Yes. And the students attending, the students there at the seminar, 20 per 25 of them, were very impolite, of course, the way Germans could be. I think they started laughing and making fun of him. Cranston was his name. He left after a while. I don't know what happened to her.
Who were some of the Americans you came across while you were in Europe?
Well, our American friends in Munich were Ernest and Victor Gilliman. They both took their PhDs while we were there. We helped them celebrate, just as we helped celebrate Walter Heitler's PhD, passing his doctoral examination. Ernst Gilliman and Victor were sons of an industrialist in Wisconsin, I believe, Milwaukee probably. They spoke German well, probably the family spoke German at home, perhaps. People thought they were Germans. Ernst became professor of electrical engineering at MIT and wrote, a very good textbook on electrical circuits or some such subject. His thesis, I think, was on electromagnetic waves, radio waves, transmission of radio. And Victor had a thesis in molecular structure, methane. I saw Ernst once or twice after them, before his death. Victor I never saw after Germany. He was working as a physicist at the Wright Aeronautics Laboratory in Dayton, Ohio. I saw a reference, I think, to his... Well, I don't know what happened. I wrote a letter and got an answer back from his son saying that Victor had died. We had German friends, especially Heitler in London. They were the two closest ones. That's flashing.
Yeah. Thank you.